Listen to our first lesson this morning from the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 2, beginning with the 18th verse. Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy wearing a linen ephod. His mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord repay you with children by this woman for the gift that she made to the Lord." And then they would return to their home. Now the boy Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and with the people. Here ends our first lesson.
Our second lesson this morning comes from the second chapter of the Gospel of Luke. Listen for the word of the Lord. Now every year, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up as usual for the festival. When the festival was ended and they started to return, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. But his parents did not know it. Assuming that he was in the group of travelers, they went a day's journey. Then they started to look for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem to search for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished, and his mother said to him, "Child, why have you treated us like this? Look, your father and I have been searching for you in great anxiety." Jesus said to them, "Why were you searching for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he said to them. Then he went down with them and came to Nazareth, and was obedient to them. His mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in years, and in divine and human favor. This is the word of the Lord. I can still vividly remember the day near the end of my pregnancy with our son, Owen. When I was sitting in our living room at home, paging through one of the many baby books that I had bought or been given that were supposed to help prepare us for the impending birth of our baby boy. I was working through the section and the checklist on Owen's layette, the collection of clothing and other various items that every infant apparently needs. A certain number of diapers, a certain number of burp cloths, a certain number of blankets, of sleepers, of onesies. It was when I got to the onesies that I burst into tears. Granted, for some women, myself included, this is an emotionally sensitive time in your pregnancy, but for sure it was the onesies that pushed me over the edge. As I thought about how many of these tiny little shirts my son would need to make it through a laundry cycle or two, in that moment, it suddenly dawned on me that when I went back to work after my maternity leave, someone else, not me, would be dressing him and caring for him during the day while I was working at the church. And that seemed overwhelmingly sad to me in that moment, thinking of all the time that I would miss being with him, time that I would never get back. But it is a reality for most modern mothers, and certainly one that we survive to the great benefit of a lovely caregiver we were lucky to find in my husband's congregation. But I couldn't help think of that moment of sadness and anxiety over Owen's shirts when I read this past week the ancient story of Hannah and her separation from her little boy Samuel and those linen ephods that she would make for him each year as a gift when she would travel to Shiloh with their family to the temple. Do you remember the story of Hannah, the first wife of Elkanah, who was barren and ill-treated by her husband's second wife, who had borne him numerous children? Hannah, who on a particular year of pilgrimage to Shiloh broke down weeping in prayer in the temple, begging God to give her the one thing that she had always hoped for, a son of her own. In her pleas, she promises to completely dedicate this hoped-for child back to God, to service to the Lord in the temple. The priest Eli finds her there, and she shares with him her vexation and her anxiety over her barrenness, and witnessing her faithfulness and her pain, he promises that indeed God will grant her request and she will find favor in God's sight. And she does conceive, and true to her promise, she brings Samuel back to the temple at Shiloh as soon as he is weaned, sealing his destiny to become one of the greatest prophets in all of Israel, who would one day himself anoint a humble little shepherd boy to become one of the greatest kings in all of Israel. Joanne Harder, pastor of Peace Mennonite Church in Lawrence, Kansas, writes this of Hannah's story. Hannah sacrifices the dailiness of raising her firstborn son, the hand-in-hand walks, the nighttime prayers, the rock collections and scraped knees and teary kisses. She has a son and then forfeits the joys of raising him, the privilege of protecting him. When Hannah leaves Samuel at the temple that first time, instead of bursting into tears, like I did, she bursts into song, singing of the greatness of her God, his power and his might and his care for his people. She sings, God raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts up the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. It's a song whose echoes we hear thousands of years later when a young girl finds herself unexpectedly pregnant with a child who she is told will be the son of God, and she too bursts into song. When Luke wrote and shaped his story of the birth and childhood of Jesus, he wanted his readers to remember Hannah and to remember Samuel, to remember the faithfulness not just of God's people in the past, but of God's faithfulness in the past, a God who acts in human history and in human time for the salvation of the world. In his classic work, The Birth of the Messiah, Raymond Brown writes, Luke uses the pigments of the Old Testament to color the stories of the infancy of Jesus. And this story of Jesus and his family in the temple in Jerusalem fits perfectly into that color scheme. Here we have another faithful family who we are told makes the annual pilgrimage of the Passover up to the temple every year from their home in Nazareth. 12 years now since the birth of their son in a borrowed stable in Bethlehem. But this year is different because this year Jesus stays behind in the temple, his parents so unaware that they start back home to Nazareth without him. Not just start back without him, but go an entire day's journey without him, 20 miles on foot, assuming that he was traveling with their friends and their relatives. This is one of the parts of this familiar story that we as modern people often get hung up on. In a world today where parents are worried about even letting their children walk alone across their neighborhood, here Mary and Joseph go an entire day without worrying about him at all. The other part that we tend to focus on is the interaction between Mary and Jesus. as she chastises him for making them worry so much. And he, with the perfect tone of a tween boy, tells her she should have known where he would be, here in his father's house. It is that statement by Jesus, that he is there in his father's house, that gets to the heart of this story that only Luke has preserved among the four Gospels. This Advent, we have heard in Luke from angels and priests, from women and prophets who have declared the identity of this holy child. But it is only here, 12 years later, a day after the Passover celebrations have ended, just an ordinary day, that we hear for the first time Jesus claim this identity for himself, that indeed he is the Son of God. For the past two centuries, Christians have wrestled with what it means for Jesus to be fully human and fully divine all at the same time, to have a human mother and a divine father, to live a real human life among us, yet sinless and embodying the very essence of God's wisdom. This is not just the mystery, but it is the gift of God's incarnation in Jesus of Nazareth. And as much as we like to see the connections between Mary and Hannah, these two mothers who bore these holy babies, in some ways, the character in Luke's story who is the most like Hannah is not Mary, but God. It is God in Luke who has dedicated this child to be fully committed in service to the Lord and to the study of Scripture. It is God in Luke who has handed his child over to others to be raised from the earliest of ages. It is God who must trust Mary and Joseph, just as Hannah trusted Eli, that Jesus would be instructed in the faith so that one day he would lead God's people. That the God who laid the very foundations of the earth, as Hannah sang, has surrendered the care of his own son for our sake, in the form not just of a man and not just of a baby, but in the form of a toddler, and then a child, and then a teenager, and then a young adult. We may not have much more insight than this story into what growing up looked like for Jesus of Nazareth, but through Luke and this story, we are given the opportunity to pause this first Sunday after Christmas to give thanks for it. Luke reminds us here that the incarnation is not just something that happened one day in Bethlehem, but something that happened every day as a part of the dailiness of Jesus' earthly life. There's such a humanness in the interaction between a mother and his son here, even in the midst of such a divine and holy declaration. In just 6 weeks, six short weeks, we will begin our journey to Jerusalem ourselves, to the cross and to the empty tomb. Hardly enough time to remember the significance of Jesus' earthly presence with us. Just imagine how differently we would understand the significance of God's incarnation if instead of a 3-year liturgical cycle, we marked a 33-year cycle, beginning with Advent and Christmas, but then spending years upon years focused on Jesus' life and God's willingness to walk the earth among us for such a time. Maybe each one of us would get to celebrate 2, maybe 3 Christmases in our lives, but it would mean that we would live as Christians in the constant awareness of the time that God gave, the lifetime that God sacrificed on our behalf. Our salvation, our atonement, our reconciliation with God is achieved not just on the cross, and not just in the empty tomb, and not just in the manger, but in every day God spent on this earth in our presence, Every day that God was willing to give for us to restore his relationship with his children. Time is one of our most valuable commodities these days. Everyone and everything seems to want more and more of it. Despite everything in our lives that is faster and easier than it ever has been, too many of us can hardly catch our breath in the face of all of the demands on our time. And so we have developed this distinction for us between the quantity of our time and the quality of our time, believing that the latter is better than the former and even more valuable to our relationships. If this was how God measured time, quantity versus quality, then indeed the life of Jesus would have played out in real time, just as it seems to in our liturgical year, in our annual celebrations. Jesus just present, touching down on earth for a few holy days, the important moments needed to complete the work of God's salvation. A Jesus present for miracles, but not for the mundane. Instead, the God who created time itself stepped into a particular moment in time to make all time holy, sacred time in the ordinariness of human life, time for Jesus to build relationships with his parents and his family, to build relationships and connections in his community, time for him to celebrate year after year after year the annual rhythms of the Jewish faith, time for him to learn and to grow, time for him to sit down in the temple and ask questions and contemplate the law of God, time to walk this earth among us day after day. We like to say that we are Easter people and that every day we live in the reality of the resurrection, which is true. But I think we're also called to be Christmas people as well, recognizing that every day is a new day of incarnation, that every day on this earth has been made holy because God was born and lived in time among us, that though God stepped into human time for one lifetime 2,000 years ago, that even today, this day, God is present in the world among us. Lawrence Stuckey, a guru in the field of worship and the liturgical year, has written this. As Christians, we ought continuously to be aware that we live at the intersection of time and eternity, but often we are not, because often God prefers to work incognito, hidden away from public acclaim. He continues, was God any less at work in our midst during nearly three decades in a Nazareth home and carpentry shop than during the brief months of Jesus' public ministry in Galilee and Judea? He finishes, this is the question theologians rarely address, but one that has profound implications for our understandings of how God labors among us. And so we are called to be mindful this Christmas of how we spend the ordinary time that we have been given, to recognize the holiness of everyday life, the time spent caring in daily care for a child, the time spent traveling this life with one another, the time spent in conversation with our children and our grandchildren, listening to their questions and taking time to be amazed at their answers. Time spent in worship as a community of faith, not just on the holidays, but every Lord's Day. Luke reminds us that just as Samuel, Jesus grew in wisdom and in years, in human and divine favor. May we this season and beyond give thanks for that growth and the time that we have been given each and every day. Amen.